Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the CFCA webinar, Refining the Task of Father Inclusive Practice. My name is Monica Campo, and I'm a Senior Research Officer in the CFCA Information Exchange here at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. Today's webinar will present evidence on what works to engage fathers in family-related services based on a recent review of the literature conducted for ORACE and the Australian Government. Two aspects of the review will be explored in today's webinar, the place of co-parenting and the notion of keeping fathers in mind. And recent mental health initiatives using digital technology with fathers will also be described. Before I introduce you to our speakers, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we are meeting. In Melbourne, the traditional custodians are the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and to the elders from other communities who may be participating today. It's now my pleasure to introduce today's presenters, Dr. Richard Fletcher and Dr. Jennifer St. George. Dr. Richard Fletcher is a senior lecturer in the Family Action Centre at the University of Newcastle. He has been conducting programs and research with boys, fathers and families for over 20 years and is the convener of the Australian Fatherhood Research Network. His current research includes fathers' roles in families with PND, young parents' strengths, father-infant attachment, Aboriginal fathering, fathers of children with autism, using the web for parent support, and supporting separated parents of young children. Dr. Jennifer St. George is a senior lecturer in family studies at the University of Newcastle. Jennifer's work in family research explores several related areas, including father engagement in human services, father's roles in child development, and parenting processes. She has a particular interest in using qualitative methodologies to explore personal and developmental aspects of family life. Now, before I hand you over to our fabulous speakers, I'll just alert you to some brief housekeeping details. One of the core functions of the CFCA Information Exchange is to share knowledge. So I'd like to remind everyone that they can submit questions via the chat box at any time during the webinar. There will be a limited amount of time for questions at the end of the presentation, and we'll try to respond to as many as possible. We also want you to continue the conversation we begin here today. To facilitate this, we will set up a web forum on the CFCA website where you can discuss the ideas and issues raised and share your own experiences of what has or hasn't worked to engage fathers. An email will be sent with more information regarding this following the webinar. Please remember that the webinar is being recorded and that the audio, transcript and presentation slides will be made available on the CFCA website shortly. And now, without further ado, over to our presenters, Dr. Richard Fletcher and Dr. Jennifer St. George.
Thank you, Monica. And good afternoon, everybody. We're here, it's the afternoon in Newcastle where we are, where Jennifer and I are sitting ready to talk to you. But we know that the invitation went out through the Men Care Network internationally, so we anticipate there might be some people in different time zones. It's a virtual seminar in that we can't see you and everything's done over the web, but Jennifer and I are sitting here in Newcastle and the land that we are meeting on from our point of view. We would like to acknowledge the traditional owners here, the Pambalong people of the Awabakal Nation, and pay our respects to elders past and present. So what I'm talking about is father inclusive practice, and my time frame for that, which is convenient since it's a decade, is the 10 years since the Father Inclusive Practice Forum. This is a forum that we convened here in Newcastle, asking people from around Australia who were practitioners, policymakers, researchers, to come and talk about where they were up to with father inclusive practice. We knew there was a lot happening, but there was no way of pulling it together or sort of linking what people were doing. And we particularly were interested in not just the programs, because as you know, it's quite possible to see programs being presented that are trying to engage fathers, some successfully. We were very interested though in what were the successful elements there, and particularly the changes that you might see in an organisational level or in procedures that an organisation engaged in. That was quite challenging for some of our presenters who were very keen to tell people about the wonderful work they were doing, understandably, but we really pushed to have more of a organisational perspective and see what difference it needed to make, because we knew from experience that one enthusiastic practitioner can be moved on and then the program stops. We identified these three areas of staff competencies, procedures and policies, and organisational changes. And some of that was a surprise to us when we pulled together the people and the material in the staff competencies, for example. When we initially put out the call, we had in mind that there might be a generic set of competencies for engaging fathers or including fathers. What we discovered through conversation with practitioners and presenters was that, in fact, there seemed to be multiple sets of competencies. So that the set of skills and attitudes and competencies you might need for running an antenatal dad's group was quite different than what you might need to running a play group, or an Aboriginal men's group, or further down the track, a group for fathers who'd been separated from their children. So we identified that there were multiple areas, more than we'd anticipated when we developed that forum in 2005. But a positive coming together, I suppose you might say, was this set of principles were agreed on. You can see that on the website under Principles of Father Inclusive Practice, there's more detail, but the headings give the idea of the range of things that we thought were important principles. None of them too controversial, I imagine. And since then, in that 10-year frame, what I'm just going to cover briefly are some of the developments that mean that now it's time to reconsider Father Inclusive Practice and hopefully take it a step further. So on the left, there's the description, or there's the cover of a Father's Matter publication that was very popular in Victoria, came out in 2009, a joint project between the Victorian Government and the Raising Children Network. The image on the right is for a Father Inclusive Practice guide, which is still available on the web, free, and is a fantastic resource. And this was a bolder project where nine of us were nominated as mentors in father engagement, and we each, in a Commonwealth project, we each were given two organisations to work with who had put their hand up to say they would like to have more fathers involved. And so over a period of about 18 months, we worked together. And that practice guide is a result of that project and still available. In South Australia, they were at that time in 2009, actually the year before this publication, the South Australian government was in the process of developing 20 new children's centres. And those children's centres, in the traditional mould, of course, would have seen nearly all mums come in for parenting programs, for mums and bubs programs, and for immunisation and other health-related activities. And the South Australian government, in this project, supported a two-year project, which was a mixture of running staff development and an action research project to try and include fathers more in those children's centres. And it was quite successful. As this report attests, which is also available on the web. It's an example of somebody taking a sort of more comprehensive approach to father inclusion and working with the practitioners on the ground and supplying some resources. So it wasn't a cheap project in that sense, but it was effective. In Western Australia, a couple of years ago, at the policy level, so this was an unusual event really, that a state government would issue a policy around fathers, and the Western Australian one is worth reading. It's a set of statements about how you should include fathers in services that are aimed at supporting families in the community. And the report referred to, that's just been published on the ERACI website that we completed for ERACI and the Commonwealth, is the evidence review of what works, and I'll come back to that. It's also important to acknowledge that there have been legal changes. Whether these follow a long time after community shifts is hard to pinpoint. That's certainly my impression. So the family law reforms, which have had a lot of attention since 2006, because of the issue of domestic violence. However, in terms of father inclusion, one of the important shifts that these law reforms signaled was to say that fathers are more important than as a playmate every couple of weekends once a family separates. Similarly, the paternity leave provisions, which began in January 2013, are minimal in the sense that they are 2 weeks of paid leave at the minimum wage compared to the 18 weeks for mothers. And I think it's important to recognise what sort of messages that indicates. But nevertheless, having paid paternity leave is an important step. However, this week there was a newspaper report of the evaluation of the PPL, the paid paternity leave scheme, and they noted that 36% of eligible fathers were taking it up. So perhaps the minimum wage aspect is one important area. NGOs are also changing in regard to father inclusive practice. The Raising Children Network, when that was set up before that 2005 forum, fathers appeared in a category along with all other sort of minor groups, and the bulk of the website was focused on mothers. Raising Children Network have since then dramatically improved the website, and I think it's a leading source now of information for fathers with a lot of detailed practical knowledge and a appropriate tone that recognises fathers' role and includes them well. Berry Street, some of you will know from Victoria particularly, a very large welfare organisation out of home care, supporting parents and running a large domestic violence program. They have 1,000 employees, and they've recently commissioned a practice guide for including fathers in all of their work. Karatani, a tertiary level centre for mothers, mainly, sleep and settling issues, a long-standing organisation. They've also just put out a father-inclusive practice guide. And there are many conferences where fathers will be talked about, and papers and presentations will be made about fathers, but I just want to acknowledge the Australian Association of Infant Mental Health Conference, because it's quite unusual for a whole conference to be focused on fathers. And that's the case this year. That's this conference in October, and Father Makes Three, looking at family inclusive practice, you know, starting from the point of starting with dad. Academia, where we're from, has also changed. We're very proud here in the Family Action Centre of our family-related courses. The Working with Men and Boys course for those looking at human services. Father-Infant Attachment, which we think is a world-first course, and Working with Vulnerable Fathers. They're all part of the Masters in Family Studies, which is a new program just started last year. Now, it might be just my impression, but I get the feeling that there's more PhDs and master's students looking at fathers and father-related topics these days. And one important influence, of course, is whether there's money around. Movember is a very successful fundraiser, and I think you can't have an organisation pump, you know, $8 or $9 million a year into an area and not have some effect. So I see that Movember's entry into the whole field, promoting the mental health, for example, of men and boys, has made a very big difference to the fathering area. And Beyond Blue, likewise, have been instrumental in raising the issue of men's depression and, as a consequence of that, fathers. And I'll talk a little bit about the Paternal Perinatal Depression Initiative, which is an initiative arising from our own work here across Australia towards the end of the slides. I think the other thing that's happened in that decade is that the evidence has got more solid, and it's solidified, or it's more robust, in these three areas. So in summary, the evidence says that fathers matter. Matter in the sense of they matter to the welfare and the well-being of infants, children, infants starting at birth, infants before birth, that fathers matter. The first area is that fathers' negative impact on children and child development is important to note. The second, of course, is that they have a positive impact. And the third is the biological connection between mothers and fathers and their infants. The first area of impact, the negative impact of infant of a father on his infant or child, is of course raised by the issue of the attention to domestic violence. But it's also important to note that we have a more attention now, and recently a publication here from ACE, on fathers' mental health. And so areas like depression we now recognise are not just, although most people think of postnatal depression as a mother's issue, we now know from the evidence that that's not the case, that fathers' mental health is also important to attend to. We also have a number of studies now which evidence fathers' positive impact when the father interacts with their children in positive ways. So the important thing about these studies is that they demonstrate an effect of the way the father plays with their child or interacts or disciplines or looks after or reads to their child. The studies demonstrate an effect that's independent of what the mother does. So in the past, fathers were thought to be important, but definitely as a second string to the mother. This evidence doesn't say that mothers aren't important, of course, but it says that fathers are also important. The third area is that we now can safely move away from the idea that mothering is biologically based and fathering is just a social event after conception. The testosterone studies now indicating levels of testosterone in men affecting their likelihood of being fathers and their behaviour once they are fathers, and also in a range of studies around hormonal influence such as oxytocin, they can demonstrate an effect on the way fathers parent, the way they do their fathering. And a recent summary from the American National Science Association on fathers' plasticity, fathers' brains' plasticity, so that fathers interacting with their infants changes their brain. And so there's now evidence that when we're talking about fatherhood, we are talking about biological factors. We also have new understanding of father-infant attachment, again saying that it's not better than mother-infant attachment or more important, but saying that it's different to mother-infant attachment in many ways, and alongside the famous strange situation procedure for measuring attachment, we now have the risky situation procedure as an acknowledgement that there might be different ways of forming an attachment. To go back to the review that we completed just at the end of last year, the areas that we identified as important for engaging fathers were not very surprising, I suppose. Staff skills and competencies, service level features, community values, and of course policy. And I'll return to some of these issues after Jennifer has quizzed you about some aspects of father-inclusive practice. So now that you've been lulled into a false sense of security, I'll hand you over to Jennifer, who's going to ask you things.
Hello. I'm going to talk you through a few areas of father engagement that we and others have found might be sticking points in the process of engaging fathers. A few years after the family law reforms in 2006, when the task of involving fathers in family services became more urgent, we undertook some research to explore practitioners' experiences of working with fathers. In particular, we focused on their confidence in working with men and their knowledge about various aspects of fathers' roles, their relationships to children, and the issues that bring them into family services. The findings of the research pointed to practitioner strengths as well as gaps, and so the checklist we developed can be useful to supervision and in staff development. Discussions provoked by responding to these questions might lead to an increased understanding of the sensitivities and responses needed for engaging with fathers. Today we thought that two questions from that checklist might help listeners focus attention on key factors in successful father engagement for practitioners. One was understanding the context and variation in men's emotional expression, and the second is knowledge about the effect of fathers on children's lives. So we're going to invite you to consider these two questions by participating in an online poll. Participation in the poll is anonymous and entirely voluntary, and you will click an option on your screen to participate in that poll. So Ken, the first question, please. So the first statement is, when fathers do not show their feelings in the sessions, it means that they are not interested. So you have three response options. One, you are reasonably confident that this statement is not correct. Two, you are unsure. Or three, you're reasonably confident that this statement is correct. You can vote right now, and you click the option on your screen, and we'll wait a few seconds, about 15, for people to participate. Please remember that it's anonymous and voluntary. We'll show you the results shortly, trusting in our technology. Great. So, among today's listeners, we have most who think that this statement is not correct. Right, return to my slides. Thanks, Ken. In our study, we found that most practitioners believe this was the case. That is, most practitioners believe that men's inexpression means that they're not interested in the sessions. But today our poll was different. Most people think that men's inexpression may not necessarily mean disengagement. One reason for this difference might be time. It's 6 years since research, and over that time, as Richard has described, there's been a growing awareness of men's emotional strengths, not just their difficulties. So, why is this a useful question for the task of father engagement in family work? As a start, such a question can prompt us to look at the characteristics and range of men's emotional expression and consider the context of mediation or counselling. It might be helpful to avoid essentialising differences among men and women and view emotional expression on a continuum. For example, meanings of emotions and emotional expression will vary across culture and families. These include rules regarding what one should and should not feel or express, and in what settings this is appropriate. Beliefs about which emotions can and cannot be successfully controlled. Also includes ideologies about emotions such as parental love or mother love, and shared understandings of how emotional experiences typically occur. So our beliefs about emotions will vary considerably, and so emotional expression is really open to subjective interpretation. Another aspect to consider here is the meaning of inexpression. Impassivity may represent fear rather than disinterest. Research suggests that a person's stillness or apparent calm may be part of their attempt to hold down strong rising emotions. And context makes a difference to discussion and disclosure. And fathers may need to experience a level of trust or connection to people in the room. Here, experienced others and mentors may be helpful. And not expressing emotions may be adaptive. When a practitioner encounters an apparently aloof or reserved father, rather than disinterested, he may be working internally very hard to understand or modify the problem and attempting to maintain personal equilibrium. Now, let's move to our second question, please, Ken. The second statement is, the father-child relationship is very important for the child's development. Again, the three response options are, one, you are reasonably confident that this is not correct. Two, you're unsure. Three, you're reasonably confident that this statement is correct. You can vote now, and we'll wait a little bit for the results. Okay. So we have most listeners today who think that this statement is correct. Back to my PowerPoint, Ken. In our study, most practitioners believe this was not the case, that the father-child relationship is not very important to the child's development. Our poll today is different. Most people think that men's relationship with the child is important to the child's development. Now, one reason for the difference might be that you've just heard Richard discuss the importance of fathers to children and families. More seriously, though, as Richard described, research on fathers and children has increased exponentially in the last decade. So why is this a useful question for refining father engagement practice in family work? First, the question can prompt us to explore just how fathers affect children positively and negatively. We know now that children's attachment bonds are not singular or exclusive to mothers. And as if you heard, fathers can be involved in different ways with different outcomes for children. Second, if we understand fathers' impact on children, then practitioners can encourage fathers to participate in family life and find windows of opportunity for engagement. For example, in the perinatal period, there are ultrasounds, antenatal appointments and classes, or for Indigenous fathers, the school environment is a fruitful gateway. Notably, practitioners can use men's desire to be a good father to encourage them into programs that will benefit their child. For example, shaken baby prevention programs, co-parenting and partnership programs, or motivational changes for DV. And when family inclusive practice is functioning, mothers can be a vital conduit for father involvement in family services. We hope that these two questions help clarify some of the thorny issues around father engagement and, importantly, inspire you to more questioning and debate. The questions and the related research will be available after the webinar. Over to you, Richard.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's a very big change, isn't it, from when we did that study? Let me go back to the report on what works from the evidence review. One of the features that stood out from the evidence that was available was that it makes sense to intervene early in men's transition to fatherhood rather than wait, as I've mentioned. And parenting and co-parenting, rather, was an important aspect, which I'll talk about some more. A third area was the current disconnect between men's behaviour change programs, which are the standard program trying to address violence in families where fathers are the perpetrators, and the fathering programs, which address fathers from the perspective of wanting to be a better father, usually. And the idea is that these two streams need to cross-fertilise so that we can have both issues addressed rather than have them as separate. The fourth point was the importance of linking programs that are happening with increases in staff's awareness and understanding and competence and community awareness. These three things do, of course, occur and not in a lockstep way. We understand that. But if you're going to be successful in improving father inclusion, in including fathers more effectively for the support of their families and themselves, then you need to be really looking at those three areas. Co-parenting. Co-parenting in the US literature particularly has an association, a very strong association with separated families like the image on the left. However, that's a particular literature that doesn't cover the idea of co-parenting because the notion of co-parenting in general looks at the way the parents support each other. So what in the US too, they've had an extensive marriage enrichment approach to trying to improve family well-being through concentrating on the relationship, the romantic relationship between the mother and the father. That by and large hasn't been very successful. And one reason we'd say that hasn't been successful is because it's missing the point. It's not just whether you two get on well. It's whether you get on well in the area of parenting, whether you undermine or support each other, whether you are able to encourage each other to be the best parent. And that in microcosm, you can see in this slide, which is from a research program, a triadic research program, from Switzerland, where what you can see on the screen are the images that are captured by the cameras in the room, and the baby's image is turned around. The camera filming the baby is you can see on the wall behind the parents, and so the baby is actually facing the parents, but they've turned the image around so we can see what's happening. And in these studies, they use a fairly simple procedure, asking the parents, as in frame one, for one of the parents to play with the baby first, then in frame two, for them to swap over and the other parent play with the baby, and frame three, for both of them to do it together, and four, to have a conversation and basically pay little attention to the baby. And if you can imagine how the varieties of that might play out. So, for example, in frame one, where the mother leans forward to play with the baby, in a co-parenting model which is successful, which is positive, then the father is looking with affection, with support at what is happening. Instead of, for example, he might look bored, look away, look at his watch, or alternatively try to intervene and compete with the mother for the baby's attention. The handover, how that happens, how one parent sits back or makes space for the other parent to have a relationship, that's featured in the second frame. And in the third frame, how do they manage together to have a relationship with an infant one at a time? And the fourth, what does the baby do when they react like that? That sort of study has identified, even before birth, before they have the baby, and in that case they use a doll with buttons for eyes and ask the parents to go through these steps. That research has identified how in microcosm that relationship, the way they support each other or undermine each other or compete with each other, has an effect on the infant's development. So this area of co-parenting is a key area for fathers, but of course it doesn't imply that you just talk to the father or run a program for the father. The parenting relationship is the issue. And in the US, the triadic research that I was just referring to is from Sweden, in the US, there's a number of studies now emerging using a fairly brief 8-week couple intervention. But the program doesn't focus just on how they get on with each other. It focuses on their parenting relationship. And in a number of studies based on 169 couples over now an extensive period, they found that a randomized controlled trial, the couples who did the intervention, who were in the 8-week program focusing on their parenting relationship, their co-parenting, those couples, and this was an antenatal program of 8 weeks, those couples experienced reduced adverse birth outcomes, reduced psychological aggression from the father, and that's a key point I'll come back to. But in the most recent follow-up of those children, those parents who 5 years ago were in an antenatal program of 8 weeks, the children of those parents have better behaviour outcomes and better school adjustment outcomes than the children in the other arm of the randomised trial whose parents did not have the parent co-parenting program. So that sort of evidence is impressive, I think, and suggesting that this area of what the parents do together to support each other is an important feature of how we might think of fathers, rather than simply thinking of fathers as the ones that we are running a program for. And I'll just point out from the study, the middle study that I just talked about, which took a measure of the aggression before they started the program, and then a measure afterwards in the randomised trial. And as you can see from this graph, the program was most effective. The difference between the two, the black and the grey bar, is most dramatic of those families where there was severe partner physical aggression, and the partner in this case is the father. So in an era where we're very concerned about domestic violence, co-parenting seems to us to be an important avenue that isn't being explored very well in Australia. So in summary, that part, father inclusive practice, if we're refining it, we'd say yes, you have to include the father, but it should support the parenting relationship, not just support the father. The second aspect I want to talk about is about the idea of keeping dads in mind, as this image shows. And here I'm thinking not so much, of course, of animals in the wild keeping dads in mind, but organisations. And one aspect of keeping fathers in mind is to recognise that fathers are not mothers. So one aspect is not to the idea of I treat everybody the same, therefore I'm including fathers. We wouldn't say that's a productive approach. We would also point out that keeping fathers in mind means, even if you think they haven't been very good at it, that as far as the children are concerned, the father will remain important to the child, even in cases where there's been violence or abuse. So that the idea that if there's been some behaviour which we find reprehensible, that that's the end of the father. Well, in the child's psyche, we'd say it's important to recognise that's not the case. Not necessarily that the father has to be brought back into the family in exactly the same way as they were before, but to say that it's not important, I think, is an error. The Western Australian policy paper that I referred to earlier, showed you the image of the cover, has this important point about parenting, which is an inclusive term. Therefore, you would say it implies both mothers and fathers. However, the use of the term is very clearly associated with services and programs and approaches that focus on mothers. And fathers are not only less responsive to the programs, but we'd say the programs are not clear in the way that they want to engage fathers if they call themselves simply a parenting program. And I want to just give you an example of where that doesn't happen. So fathers aren't being kept in mind. This is the Home Interaction Program for Parents and Youngsters, a Melbourne-based, based at the Brotherhood St Lawrence program, which involves parent support. It's free. It's involved home-based work. It's an enrichment program. It's been going many years now, well since 2009. And this year expects to operate in 50 locations with 3,000 families. It's a very successful program. But in their reports, I noted that although 72% were couple families, 98% of the participants were female. And so the participants, that is the mothers, were the ones who demonstrated increased confidence, increased parenting skills, understanding of school requirements, and improvements in their mental health. And that in itself is a good result, of course, and the results for children are also positive. So what I'm saying now is not meant to imply a criticism of the program. What I'm pointing to in this program is the absence of keeping fathers in mind, because in the reports that document the success of this program and reports which ask, how could we recruit better? How could we keep more families in HIPPI in that program? When you go through that report, you'll know, even though there's a picture of a dad there on the cover, that in these reports there is absolutely no discussion of fathers. So the fathers are not talked about in terms of how they helped, whether they hindered the process, whether they benefited, whether they might be engaged. So a report like this one, which is a very extensive report, taking a lot of care to document how families are recruited, that is, in this case, how mothers are recruited and how they're retrained, there is not a mention of fathers. And so keeping fathers in mind is not, of course, to argue that this program and others like it should endeavour to have 50-50 and every mum who comes in the door or every mum who's engaged in the program, there has to be a dad. That's not what we mean by keeping fathers in mind. What we mean is that thinking about fathers and noting, for example, in this program, why don't we know what happened with the fathers and why aren't we then in a position to say, well, if we do want to get more fathers in, we have this evidence to go on. So we understand that keeping fathers in mind doesn't mean the physical presence of a father in every interaction. And if you're thinking about families where there might have been abuse or violence, that obviously isn't the simple solution to improving father inclusion. we would say the simple solution, there isn't a simple solution probably, but we would say the most simple step forward is to start thinking about, well, where are the fathers and what are we doing to engage them in a way that supports the family rather than ignore them. And I'll just tell you about two projects that we have at the moment which try and apply this logic. In the first case, and they're both around new fathers, so with funding from Movember and Beyond Blue, the University of Newcastle is undertaking an SMS for Dads project. And the idea of that is to recognise that while mothers have a number of points of contact with health services, from booking in visits and antenatal visits through to home visits and seeing their GP, that fathers have very few places where they have to have contact. And in order to keep them in mind and in order to keep the health services and the support that's available in the father's minds, we are suggesting that perhaps SMS is a good way, since all fathers, or near enough to all fathers, have mobile phones. So this project seeks to enrol fathers in a mobile phone-based project where we send them SMS messages and we check on their mood, because we know that father's mood is important for the child's development. The texts cover father-infant care and looking after the mother, co-parenting, and the father looking after himself. And the idea is that the texts arrive, they're free, of course, if you are in this project. They're free and they arrive without you having to do anything, so all you've got to do is either read them or delete them. They're low intrusion value, I suppose. And we also want to check up how the dads are going. So this image captures the idea that whether he's at work, where he may get support but often may not, that the father... The idea of the SMS for Dad's mood tracker is that the SMS messages ask him how he's going. And if he says that he's not going well, then he's called, he's telephoned, to try and pick up early those dads who might be in distress leading up to the birth or following the birth. A separate project, which is a project funded by the University of Newcastle and the Young and Well Research Cooperative, is a project under the name of Staying on Track, and as you can see from the photo, involves young Aboriginal dads. These dads are part of a larger group who are building a website. These men in the photo are not designing the electronics of it, the software. An expert is doing that, but these men are designing the software, designing the website for young Aboriginal dads. They are using their own stories of being a dad, how they learned about being a dad, how they experienced the birth and subsequently. That's the basis of the website. And in that project, they are also going to be involved in a mood tracker to test how such an idea, that is getting messages on your phone asking you to say how you are on a scale, and then be contacted if things aren't going well. They're also testing that. So those two projects, we would say, are examples of keeping fathers in mind without trying to necessarily have the father physically present with the mother when you're running some sort of program or running an initiative. These are resources, and I imagine you can screenshot them or wait till you get the copy from AFES or ERACI, and you'll be able to follow these things up by going to those resources, most of which are free. On behalf of Jennifer and myself, I'd like to thank you for logging on and for participating in the questions, and we wish you well in your own endeavours to include fathers. Thank you very much.